So, welcome everybody. This is the 11th and last lecture in my course on the Arahant and the Four Truths in Early Buddhist Discourse. I'll start again with the things from the blog. First of all, we are still with the discourse that we discussed 2 weeks ago on the marvels related to the Buddha's birth. There's a comment by Bhikkhuni Suvimali. She says that there's a psalm among many psalms eulogizing the god Indra, or Saka he is called in Buddhist discourse. He was born in the same way as the Bodhisattva was born, from his mother's side, and as soon as he was born he stood up and took 7 steps, or lotuses I think, and announced that he was the chief. To my mind, these accounts of the Bodhisattva's birth reveal and reflect the Brahmanic influence that infiltrated into the Buddhist canon via monk editors of the canon in the past. Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting observation, because in a way, you see these two discourses on marvels that we have been looking at in more detail, the one on the marvels related to the Buddha's birth and the other one on the marvels related to Bakula. They both can be seen as exemplifying certain Indian tendencies or trends. The first one, this Brahmanic influence, this devotional attitude, this turning the Buddha into something more akin to a god than to a human being. And the other discourse showing us the influence of the Shramanic element. The Shramanas or Samanas in Pali, this is the Indian recluse tradition, the ascetic tradition. And we see there how this has influenced what I believe we can consider a change in the Arahant ideal from the early, more properly Buddhist-speaking type of conceptualization of the perfected being. So I thought that was a very helpful comment that made me see more clearly these kind of two, I think in the contemporary situation in ancient India, probably the two predominant type of influences that would have exerted themselves on the early Buddhist tradition, the Brahmins and the Shramanas, the recluses. And there was a reply to this comment by Suvimali from John. He says, I see in myself a need or a desire for there to be a pure original teaching that just happens to be agreeable to me and my own cultural and individual background. I feel myself latching onto this new information like, aha, this story actually came from over there, so I can skip it. I suppose it's inevitable that we all parse the Dharma based on our own perspectives and histories. So we just need to stay mindful of that and acknowledge which perspective we are taking up at any moment. Yeah, I find that very, very useful. I can very much relate to that. And I think there is something to it also to some degree. As John rightly says, as long as we are aware of our preferences, I think it is actually purposeful also and meaningful to make distinctions, and this is what in part this historical critical method is about. Perhaps not, he is probably meaning this in a little bit humorously, like a pure original teaching, but there are earlier layers and there are later layers in the canonical scriptures. And while we are academically speaking not able to go back to the historical Buddha and say the Buddha said this and that, we are able to say like this material here seems to be early and this material seems to be later. And so the early material stands much greater chances of being close to or reflecting the original teaching. And this is precisely what we are getting into with these two marvels, the marvels related to the Buddha, and perhaps most strikingly even for most of us, this marvelous monk Bakula, whom we find so difficult to see why he is actually marvelous. So perhaps reformulating Jean, I would say, aha, this story actually came from over there, so I can understand it, not skip it. Maybe that's my personal feeling. I think I said last time that this chapter on marvels, when I recite through the Majjhima Nikaya, is a real challenge for me. Because you first get this 121, 122, this very profound discourses on emptiness, and then you get the Buddha's marvels, and then you get Bakula. Oof, so I can really see myself wanting one part of the chapter very much, and the other part not at all. But yeah, the point is, as I had to learn myself, and John is agreeing with me, he's giving us a smile, is not to skip it, but to understand it, put it into context, and go beyond the emotional response towards an understanding of what it means and signifies. And that is actually quite significant then. But before we come to Bakula, there is a question by Sister Akinchana. There's a question. Maybe I leave a place for queries and comments regarding to the Buddha's birth marvels before I go to the next topic. That was the Madhyama Agama discourse we took up 2 weeks ago, and then we will shortly look at the one that has no parallels, the story about Ananda, and then we are all set for Bakula. Mark says, are we sure the Brahman story is the source? How about the other way around, or common source for both stories? Well, Mark, we can never be 100% sure, but the Rig Veda, where Suvimali got that story from, is very, very old. So it seems it is impossible that the Buddhist story could have influenced the Rig Veda. But we cannot be sure that it comes exactly from there. It is possible that the Rig Veda took up some kind of archetype, type of story that was around about being born from the mother's side, and I have to say I haven't seen that passage. Bhikkhuni Suvimala is still going to pick it up for us. So I'm talking just based on her information. I have not seen the passage myself, but assuming that the passage is the way she describes it, it's possible that this story just fluctuated around in the general Indian context and was then taken up here and there by different traditions. So that need not be a direct influence. But the fact that it is found in the Rig Veda, which is very, very old ancient Indian scriptures, makes it quite positive to decide that it was not, it did not arise originally in a Buddhist context. Yeah, then coming to the next discourse, Madhyama Agama 33, Mark says, yeah, he agrees, the Rig Veda is quite old. She was asking me about the sources from Madhyama Agama 33. You might remember that was this discourse I didn't really present in full with all these small bits and pieces about Ananda. Yeah, and so this is actually a very, very interesting point, because it is particularly in the Madhyama Agama we get these discourses that collect different pieces of information related to a particular monk. And this actually reflects the whole theme of the chapter we are engaging with. I mean, I think we have to picture ourselves in that ancient Indian situation. The Buddha has passed away. And at that time, obviously nobody knows that this is going to be a huge world religion, in quotation marks, that's going to last for 2,500 years. Just that you hear, you're told about, oh, there was this wonderful teacher and he's passed away. And yeah, there are some people, they still remember what he taught. You go there and listen to them. So that's a situation. Everything is fluctuating. You don't know what's going to happen. There's no scriptures. There are no Buddha statues. There are no temples. So there is some need for those who are not of the totally rational type that just want to, just tell me what he taught and that's it, I don't want to know anything else, I'm going to meditate. But there's all this need for some type of personal engagement, for something that arouses inspiration, that gives you this inner feeling of happiness and confidence. And so out of this whole situation, I think there are these different things that develop. One is this elevation of the Buddha until he becomes a miraculous being that flies from here to there, or earthquakes happening whenever he does anything. And we also get in the lead of the Buddha being elevated, then also some of the monks are being elevated. So the beginning is a sense of history, trying to have some idea of some historical idea. Like, not only the Buddha taught such and such, but at one time he was in such and such a place, and then he taught this. And then some longer story, the Mahaparinivana Sutta, the discourse on the great disease of the Buddha, is passing away. Well, we get all this, the beginning of a historical narration, and then a more complex historical narration of how the order came into being in the Vinaya, giving a background to why all these rules were promulgated. We get individual stories, but at the beginning of the Vinaya, we get this attempt to give a history of Buddhism in a certain way. And then we get these ideas of giving a history of individuals. And later on we get that in the commentaries to verses, Therigata, Theragata, to the Edadagavaga, the listing of outstanding disciples in Anguttara Nikaya, they give some story. Like, look, there's this monk named so-and-so, in his past life, this and this happened, and in this life, this and this happened. It fleshes out, we are still in India, right? We have no pictures, no books, nothing. We just get these names, Ananda said. So we want something that fleshes out who is this Ananda for us. We'll never be able to see him, he's passed away already. So we want all this information, and the beginning of this creation of history of individuals that later on informs the Avadana genre in Buddhist literature, where we get these whole stories of the past, begins obviously by collecting the pieces from the present life. So this is my suggestion for the sources for Madhyama Agama 33, that in this oral tradition we have the discourses spoken by the Buddha, we also get some discourses spoken by disciples and some information about disciples. All this floats around in this oral transmission. Like, say you come and I tell you Ananda said this and this, and after this course you ask me, who is this Ananda? And I say, you know, he was the Buddha's foremost attendant, and he became a stream mentor in this way, he became an arahant in this way, and there's some stories I can tell you about him, look, and blah, and I give you all these stories. And so this slowly condenses into a discourse. It's a very natural process, I think. And the interesting thing is that we have this, in the Madhyama Agama, we have several of these pieces. We have also pieces on Anuruddha. And obviously on Sariputta, we had this whole chapter that we read together. So it's this beginning of collecting information on the disciples to give some historical background to the situation. And as Venerable Akinchana rightly said, some of these pieces from Madhyama Agama 33 are known in the Theravada tradition as well. Even we find one piece in the Vinaya about how he became an arahant. Yeah, that is just on Madhyama Agama 33. And again, if there are questions, there's the time for it. And then we go into what has been inspiring a lot of discussion on the blog and perhaps also now in class, our friend Bakula. Yeah, then I start. So first I start with like two warnings given by some of our companions. One is by Sylvester. I have a little bit reformulated his presentation, but I hope I still catch his ideas. So he says, in our culture we have certain ethical values. They're definitely different from the ethical values 2,500 years ago. Our culture is different from the culture 2,500 years ago. Shortly, I have no idea about the type of thinking 100 years ago. Even more so, I have no idea about the type of thinking 2,500 years ago. So that I thought was a very good warning for us to keep in mind that obviously we are dealing with a different culture at a very far removed time. So it is easy to presuppose that our way of evaluating our ethical values and our ideas are valid for that situation also, and they are not. This does not mean that we have to get in this kind of agnostic attitude, yeah, I can't know anything, and I don't think that was also what Sylvester meant. Just for us to keep in mind that if we get too heated up, which sometimes happens to me, that slowly, you are really working from this spectacles of your own, looking at the thing, but actually at that time they didn't wear this kind of spectacles. And another one, a very sweet reminder from Wei Yin Shou. She says, it appeared to me that most of us form some kind of view leaning towards the unskillful, towards this person. Shouldn't we instead be understanding, have equanimity, if not compassion, appreciative joy, or if that is possible, loving kindness? Yeah, in fact, I had myself the feeling that I was getting a little bit heated up last time. I think I said that at the end, that I apologize if I got too much. It's kind of this Bakula story, and this whole topic of the position of women in Buddhism is something that is very close to my heart, and in a way I find it easy to get carried away, and I'm very appreciative if someone tells me, listen, remember Brahmaviharas. Yeah. Okay, now I get into some more detailed comments, and you just feel free whenever something comes up to put any question or query you have. This is Venerable Akinchana. She says, so this is actually a sutta in Majjhima Nikaya later than the first Buddhist council, and it implies that the list of Etaragga disciples in Anguttara Nikaya is also later than the first council. I find this interesting in connection with the account of the foundation of the Order of Nuns. Are there any other such late pieces in Majjhima Nikaya? When was it finalized? Yeah, so I think, first of all, we have to distinguish two perspectives. I think one is the text immanent perspective. What do the texts themselves say about when they were finalized? And the other one is the academic perspective we would have on it from based on other evidence. So if we just talk in terms of from the text immanent perspective, there are here three more discourses which explicitly say that they took place when the Buddha had already passed away. That's the Madhura Sutta, just talking Majjhima Nikaya, 84, Gotamukha Sutta, 94, and Gopakarmogalana Sutta, 108. This is the texts themselves say that the Buddha had already passed away. However, somebody from within the tradition then could argue that these discourses took place between the time the Buddha passed away and the time the discourses were recited at the so-called First Council. So, in theory, one could still argue that this must have been already finished by the time the First Council took place. This type of argument does not work with the Bakula Sutta, because clearly it implies that a considerable time has passed since the time Buddha had passed away. The conclusion that the Etaragga part in Anguttara Nikaya needs to be laid, I am not sure about that. The Etaragga section is a part in Anguttara Nikaya which lists certain disciples which are outstanding for particular qualities. And so the fact that there Bakula is mentioned to be outstanding for his health, he could have been known for that quality already at a time earlier than the Bakula Sutta. I'm just taking the traditional perspective now, trying to argue. So if I argue like that, I could say, well, maybe after some 30 years of him being a monk, Buddha was still alive, and it was already known, wow, this monk is never getting sick, he's very, very healthy, and he already got this rank. And I could even argue the Buddha has the ability to foresee the future. He knew that Bakula would not become sick for the rest of his life, so he gave him that rank. So I don't think there is a necessary connection from the Bakula Sutta of Majjhima Nikaya to the Anguttara Nikaya, this part, and to any other part of the Anguttara Nikaya being late. But this is just the text immanent position. Obviously, from a historical academic perspective, we see things different. And we would in generally assume, and this is a thing I have argued in a paper that recently came out, that the discourse collections must have been finalized by the time of Ashoka, more or less, at least as far as their main content is concerned. Because King Ashoka was such a famous symbol for the Buddhist traditions, but he's never referred to. And also the geographical awareness that we have in the suttas is much more limited than Ashoka's realm. And there's no real reference that shows us a wider geographical awareness. I have to put a little bracket here. There is a reference to Yona, which by some scholars has been taken as a sign that there's awareness of the Bactrian Greeks and thus of Alexander the Great, etc. This is not entirely correct. This reference to Yona, as I've shown in detail somewhere else, seems to refer to an event that took place before the Buddha's lifetime. There was a war, the Persians attacked Greece, and the Spartans defended Greece at the famous leader Leonidas. All this happened long before the Buddha's time, and there was an Indian contingent in the Persian army that attacked Greece. And so it seems that the reference to Yona we get in one discourse would refer to that. So from a historical perspective, what we would say is there is no evidence for major doctrinal, geographical, political aspects of the time of Ashoka and after Ashoka in the discourses. There is one poem at the end of the discourses on the Buddha's passing away, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, that apparently was added only in Sri Lanka at the time when the text came to Sri Lanka during the time of Ashoka. But this poem is also found in Sanskrit fragments of the Mula Savastivada, Savastivada tradition. So it is pretty probable that this poem was not created in Sri Lanka, but it came along with the oral tradition. And it is explicitly recorded in the commentaries that this was added. So, as far as I can see, we can be fairly sure that by the time in the first century before Christ, the first century before the present era, when the discourses were written down, they were closed. And that they pretty much reflect us the development of those about 200 years, roughly, from the Buddha's time to the time of King Ashoka. So all the developments that we are discovering here, like the development of the Arahant ideal, would have to be placed within this 200-year period. Since this is a little important for our general work with this comparative study, I just want to pause and see if there is some principal question on this rough historical sketch that I presented. Good, then we continue with our friend Bakula. There was one comment from Wayne Shaw, I'm giving it just very shortly. She says about his health, his being outstanding for health, which is also why he's listed in the in the chapter on the outstanding disciples, that perhaps he is the perfect embodiment of a human being. And I thought that was a very interesting idea. I mean, she meant it in terms of beauty, and Olga on the blog already pointed out that doesn't work so much because he was already too old to be attractive. But a perfect embodiment in the sense of the perfect meritorious being. And that is something that I hadn't thought about. And Linda has gotten into this subject a little more in detail. And that had really helped me clarifying my understanding about this particular quality of Bakula. She says, simply that he had good health, it seems to put the emphasis on the past. I assume the idea being that he must have developed such good karma in the past that it resulted in perfect health in this life, and thus this was such a marvelous thing. Before I continue reading, I like to pause for a moment because I think that is in fact precisely the point that is being highlighted in this quality. The idea is that he is such a perfectly meritorious being. He's so full of merits that he won't ever get sick. This is not stated in the discourse, but I think Wayne Cho and Linda together have brought me there to a better understanding of this part. And this fits with this whole discourse, which is in fact not really describing a historical person, but it's describing the imagination of the reciters, how they feel, what is Superman, Supermonk, yeah, he's Supermonk. He is so meritorious that he doesn't get ever sick, and he is so ascetic that he doesn't do this and this, and he doesn't eat this and that. And this very fact shows us again the lateness. And there I continue with Linda's quote. She says, what if Anatta Pindika, for example, had been praised simply for the fact that he was wealthy instead of the fact that he was generous with his wealth? Seems this would have been putting the emphasis the wrong way around. That is precisely the thing, and I think that is the underlying feeling that many of us get with this discourse, that it's putting the emphasis the wrong way around. And this is not just that we are projecting our values and ideas on a text 2,500 years ago. We do to some extent, but it's actually because we are comparing it with other discourses and what they are emphasizing there. And we see that there's a difference here. It's a very clear difference. And that Anatta Pindika example was very useful to point that out, because that's precisely the thing. That Anatta Pindika was richest, yeah, that's not really the issue. The issue was he was generous. So this marvelous monk who doesn't do anything for others, and is just being outstanding for health, that for his accumulation of merits, it shows a clear shift, I think. And it has this whole tendency that comes so much in later tradition also to increasingly look at the past, what somebody has done in the past, and not look at what they're doing right now. There's a comment by Hugo. I have read elsewhere that Bakul has an incredibly good reputation as having done so many good deeds during the time of other Buddhas that he only needed to come for one more life to become an Arhat. Yeah, perfect, Hugo. That precisely fits. When I studied Bakula, I might have come across this, but it's only now that Wayne and Linda's pointed out that it had really clicked in my mind, because I was just seeing that contrast. You see, good health has nothing to do with being a Buddhist or being a Buddhist monk. Anybody can have good health. All the other qualities we usually get is they have to do something with the practice of the Dharma or with morality. Some of these Buddhist values can in some way be brought in. But the fact that he's just healthy, I mean, with that explanation that he did not under the time of other Buddhists, we get a slightly Buddhist flavor to his accumulation of merits. But the very fact of being healthy has nothing to do with Buddhism. So that's very useful. See, I keep learning from all of you. And there's another comment from Linda. I have a question about how he goes around to all his fellow monastics to inform them to come because he will attain final nibbana that day. Is this kind of behavior announcement commonly depicted for other arahants? Yeah, I'm not aware of this kind of public display of passing away in precisely that form, asking the others to come. However, there is this element of display in final attainments of nirvana. We have that with the Buddha's passing away, and this then successively goes also applied to some of his disciples. There are, like in the Theravada tradition, there is the belief that only the Buddha could manifest certain miracles, like manifesting fire and water. But then with other traditions, we get other disciples doing that or doing marvels at the time of passing away, that they walk around in the sky and then they do the same thing as the Buddha did, go through all the jhanas up and down. So there's this basic idea of a display of marvels at the time of the passing away of a fully awakened one seems to be already there. Only this act that, hey, you all come together, I'm going, this kind of announcement, I am not offhand aware of other instances. Linda had posted that comment just shortly before this lecture, so I didn't have time to further research this, but I am offhand, I don't remember other instances in the early discourses where an arahant on passing away calls the others together. This one interesting instance that I recently studied, and I've just written a paper on this in the Udana, there's a monk who asks permission from the Buddha and then he burns himself. He goes up into the sky and disappears in a flame. But again, he doesn't call others to come and witness that. In fact, the Buddha later on tells the story to the monks, so one has the impression at that time it was just this monk, Dabba he's called, and the Buddha, they were just more or less alone, or with just few spectators. Anyhow, let me see, there's some questions here. But we have read in last or before last lecture that health depends on mind. I'm not quite sure, Hugo, what do you have in mind? Health depends on mind. I mean, the fact that I'm healthy now is an expression of my merits from the past, according to Buddhist doctrine. And this is, I think, what Linda was trying to point out. My present mental condition does not have so much influence on my health actual health condition, whether I never get sick or not. It has an effect on how I deal with pain and how I deal with being sick, but that's a different, slightly different question. So there are fully awakened ones who can regularly get sick. The Buddha himself got sick. He had back pain and other diseases. So the fact that Bakula in the present life never got sick, which I assume would also refer to the period before he became a monk, does not necessarily reflect his present mental condition. Just as we say somebody who practices a lot of the Brahmaviharas, loving kindness, etc., will become beautiful in a future life, doesn't mean that anybody now who is beautiful must be a very nice metta practitioner, and anybody who is ugly must be a very angry person. This is one thing is the imprints from the past that lead to certain results. The other thing is what you do at present about it. And so somebody who is not particularly beautiful and attractive can be full of metta, compassion, etc. I hope I didn't misunderstand you. Yeah, then there's another comment on Bakula that was made by Robert and by Olga. I'm posting in here the version by Olga. She says, maybe he lived the way he did to encourage other monks who are still in training to live the same way, just to be an example for those who are still to overcome greed and passion. So instead of teaching anyone by means of direct communication, he just lived the way from which those who have not yet reached the final goal would benefit. Yeah, I think this basic idea of teaching by way of example is something that is very alive in early Buddhism and also in Asia. It's very interesting. Much of the monastic training you get if you go and ordain in a monastery in Asia and you're a Westerner, you kind of expect, now they should tell me what I should do. And you expect to get like maybe a listing of what time you've got to get up and what time you do this and that. But unless they are used to having Western students, that's not really the way it works. The way it works usually is by a non-spoken communication. You suddenly see everybody is sweeping and they're smiling at you, and the next day you see they're sweeping and they're no longer smiling at you. You understand, hey, I'm meant to be sweeping with the others. Nobody's going to tell you, look, every day after breakfast we all sweep the place. It's just you're supposed to notice that. You see everybody is sweeping and should be clicking in your mind. And when one is not used to that type of communication, then some Westerners find it very difficult. They want everything. Why don't they tell me? They can tell me, no? Then I come. But that's not how it works. And it's a very interesting way, because it's a way of teaching that inculcates a lot of mindfulness and a lot of metta in a way also, because you have to keep observing the others and have to keep that feeling of kindness, acceptance of how things are different and trying to fit in to learn the lesson. And when you do that, it really strengthens the meditation practice actually. But in the case of Bakula, I'm not so sure, because he was living in the midst of the community, but he was not participating in community activities. So say, for example, if he wants to be an example for others, it would be really nice if he takes up a few novices. The novices need training, so if he looks after them, then he can be an example for them. But he, as far as the way he's described to us, he completely cuts himself off from any way of a type of interaction between monastics, between monastics and lay people, that will be of benefit for others, except for this merit thing. That is precisely the one theme that I finally understood after getting help from Wayne Shaw and Linda, that this merit theme, he is very meritorious. He's an arahant. He's an ascetic. So the way you get merits, giving him robes, giving him food, that way still works. Well, even with the robes, it doesn't really work so well, because it doesn't accept robes from lay people. So you have to be really tricky. You have to prepare red robes and move in his watch and put them there for him. But at least he must be getting food somewhere. So there's one way for us to be making merit. But the example, as an example for those still in training, I think, and there was a story that Juliana shared on the blog that showed how this example can go offhand, I think it would actually be a misleading example. I think I would rather have somebody like Venerable Sariputta, whom we have met, or even Venerable Ananda, who is not yet an arahant, as my example, because they show a way of keeping the training, keeping morality, that is much more integrative and holistic. So I think it's good to keep this idea in mind that he served an ascetic as an example, and that in the discourse that we are reading, he's actually meant to be an example. That is definitely the case. But I don't see him as an example in the historical situation. Mark, Bakula seems to serve as an archetypal figure to inspire renunciation. He's not meant to show the whole of the monastic life, just this one aspect. Yeah, I understand that, and I think you're perfectly right that Bakula is not meant to be the only type, but at least in this, he is one of the, I think only two monks in this chapter, only Ananda and Bakula, no? Then the rest is lay people, I believe. And Dharma, yeah. There's only two monks chosen for being marvelous in this whole chapter. And this is the chapter on marvels. So after the Buddha, we get Ananda, which I fully understand. And then we get Bakula. These are two very opposite ideas. And I think the fact that he's being put there and that we get this acclamation, it's so wonderful that he does that. It does mean that he's not just like one out of 100 different options, and the other 99 are so much more important, but he is being highlighted as an ideal arahant. And I do not see myself how he could be inspiring renunciation, because what I see in him is in fact not renunciation. It's an exhibition of a flawless ascetic conduct in line with the shamanic ideas of the time, that misses out on Buddhist qualities. And here I have a nice, comes almost as a reply to what you said from Hedwig. She says, Bakula received this wonderful teaching when all of him became an arahant, and the feeling of gratitude has not arisen in him. He received something from the Sangha and is not giving it back to the Sangha. This kind of gratitude naturally arises. In my own experience, it just developed naturally that the little you really understood, that this much one shares with others. this lack of sharing and Bhakula's behavior is very strange, and it's more likely to me that he was not an arahant at all. Well, the last conclusion is strong, but I think the point that Hedvig is making is precisely that. You see, there are these other examples, like whenever Revata is also an arahant, and he almost never appears because he always off somewhere meditating. He just wants to be alone. That's perfectly fine. But you get his poem, and in the poem he says, "Oh, I'm full with metta for all beings." Sababhuto. Yeah, beautiful poem. And that is what he feels is outstanding about him. So that gives me a completely different flavor, and that inspires renunciation, at least in me. There's another comment by Hedwig. Another question has arisen in my mind concerning teaching the Dhamma. Why are there silent Buddhas? In case of Bhakula, it would have been better if he had been a silent Arahant instead. And there's another comment by Adam also. He says, the representation of Bhakula reminds me slightly of the Pacheka Buddha type, which seems also to have been venerated in society. I suppose Bhakula could have been seen as incorporating a slightly different type of Samana practitioner tradition into the Sangha. And that's precisely the point. Yeah. So we have this Pacheka Buddha idea that in the early suttas makes its manifestation very sporadically and becomes a little stronger afterwards. We find a lot of that in the Ekotarika Agama, where an Agama collection that has remained open for a longer time. The basic idea is somebody on his own at the time when there's no Buddha around reaches full awakening, but his merits, his practice is not sufficient to enable him to explain this to others. So he becomes a silent Buddha or a solitary Buddha, a Pacheka Buddha. And these Pacheka Buddhas, according to tradition, exist at the time when there's no Buddha around. And then there's obviously the Sammasambuddha, like the Gautama Buddha, who, similar to the Pacheka Buddha, finds awakening on his own but is able to teach. And then those who are his disciples who learn it from a Buddha and become an Arahant. So there's no silent Arahant, like Hedwig said. Nice idea. He's a little bit of silent Arahant. But I think the important and helpful suggestion that we get here from Hedwig and Adam is that just as the Pacheka Buddha has a lot of qualities of the ascetic type, Bhakula is really the representation of the ascetic ideals of contemporary India, brought back into Buddhism. There's a constant conflict, is maybe a little bit too strong, but the two poles we find in the tradition, and there's that where I actually personally see also much of the way the Buddha is shown, and particularly his disciple Ananda, this softness, openness to women, no fear of women, integration, more holistic approach, and seeing for the essence of things and being able to accommodate. And then there is this other ideal, which comes very strong in other ascetic traditions also, this emphasis on outer strict conduct, on maintaining particular forms of ascetic conduct, strictness, and there also is often this undercurrent of wanting to have nothing to do with women. Women are difficult. There's a very nice thing, we'll come to that soon, on that topic. And again, it is perfectly understandable that as soon as the Buddha has passed away and this central authority is no longer there that can guarantee the genuineness of the approach to the Dharma, that naturally the tradition latches on to externals. And there's this thing, I mean, even at the Buddha's time, according to the way this is depicted in the discourses, there were people who thought themselves to be Arahant and they were not. and the Buddha would have had the authority to say, look, this overestimation. No. But once he's gone, there's nobody really who can say, this is yes. Nobody who can confirm. And with that, there is a natural tendency to look for outer manifestations of arahantship. And then it is again natural, with the pressure of surrounding other groups, all these groups competing for support from the laity, that there is a natural tendency towards those displays, those outer displays of ascetic virtue that are being estimated in the general Indian context. And this inevitably is at the loss of those inner Buddhist qualities. So I think if we look at it in that way, we can see that there's a natural tendency, and that there's, just as we saw with the marvels of the Buddha's birth, this influence of the Brahmin tradition, then here we see this ascetic ideal, the Samana or Shramana tradition, that finds its, that manifests. And that is, I think, if you look at it, there's a natural process. And here's Bobbert. He says, somehow to me the impression of selfishness prevails, and the question remains why the sutta was included in the text. And then he's right. There is this depiction of the perfect ascetic misses out on essential aspects of the inner Buddhist training, and this is why we get this impression that he's selfish, or we almost wonder, is he really an arahant? But why the sutta was included, I think maybe this has become clear now, precisely because in that survival condition after the Buddha's passing away, it was necessary to find some way of accommodating this ascetic ideal held by other traditions, and monks were coming from other traditions and then ordaining as Buddhist monks. They were carrying with them these ideals. There's this whole question, Mahakasyapa is a symbol of these ascetic ideals. Another question is the Devadatta story, the story about somebody who, according to what the texts tell us, he created a schism in the early monastic community by proposing a more ascetic conduct, which the Buddha was not willing, according to what the texts say, to accept as binding for all of his monastics. There is this constant need of dialoguing. A tradition that has departed from the ascetic trend, but is still seeing itself as a member of the wider Samana community. And so it is only natural, I think, that these stories manifest, these tendencies manifest, and we get this Devadatta story, which as time goes on becomes the most evil person you could possibly imagine. We get this Mahakasapa, who even now, I had that 2-3 years ago at a meditation retreat, I had a monk from India who was just refusing to talk. So he to improve his meditation, which is a little difficult when, I mean, I'm not really a chattery kind of person, but if you teach a course, it's nice if you ask the meditator for something in particular, if they reply to you, you see. And he had this little note saying, just like Mahakasapa. He was trying to live up to this ideal of Mahakasapa. Actually, Mahakasapa talked, he didn't keep silent, but that was just this ideal in his mind that he was trying to live up to. And Bakula is another such idea. This is Linda on the same topic. I'm still curious though how such a radically different picture of the Arahant came to be emphasized in a relatively short time after the Buddha. I can see that certain ascetic ideals might have been emphasized to give a certain impression in order to counter the picture of some monastics who may have been lax or to inspire those not practicing properly, but it seems extreme, such a different emphasis, and without mentioning any of the real essential qualities. Yeah, I agree. I've already replied a little bit to this. It's a radically different picture, and it's really surprising that it happened within such a short time. But at the same time, I think the very fact that the Buddha had just passed away and the community was just struggling for survival makes it understandable why something happened relatively soon. Yeah, and Linda is right. It was not particularly well done. They could have put in a few of the essential qualities. I mean, could have also said he's marvelous because of his morality, concentration, wisdom. 2-3 of those qualities would have made it a little bit more tasty for us, I think. Here's Juliana. And the point problem at stake doesn't seem to me to be necessarily the Arhant Bakula himself, but rather the way he comes to be represented. To what extent it is Bakula who is speaking, and to what extent has he been made into speaking in a certain way which is ideologically functional to a certain agenda? Bakula functioning as a source of legitimation and example. This depiction is aimed at providing illustrious antecedent role model for certain types of misbehaviors, arrogance, misogyny, and so forth. Yeah, I thought that was that really brings us back to the point. And now I have a beautiful thing from Rodolfo, which touches on the issue of that this whole attitude of hating women, being afraid of women. I thought that was so nice. So he says, let's say you see a nice sport car and your mind gets agitated because of the wish to own it, to ride it, to drive it. Craving arises and you blame the car. Then you ban cars out of the street because they disturb your practice. And you talk all the bad things that cars have, noisy, contaminating. Inside they're full of oil and gas that is dirty. The exhaust pipe smells bad, etc. At the end, you're banned from touching a car or being transported by a ride one because the car is contaminating and noisy. Not touching a car now is a virtue. Does it make sense? I thought that was just such a beautiful example. The practice is to watch how you relate to things. To ask the things to change or to get away is totally contrary to the practice. To be a control freak and letting go are exact opposites. I understand that you need some isolation at the beginning until you can develop some detachment from sensuality. If you're trying to detach from cars, don't go to a car exposition. But do not blame it on cars. We're all born from a woman. We receive love first from a woman. So even the most advanced monks have the first experience of love and compassion in this life from a woman. Yeah, I thought that was very beautiful. And now I have a final quote from Rosa to get us back into gear. She just says, I think there's always a chance to practice letting go. I'm just writing this new Satipatthana book, and this is precisely what I was writing on the Bhujangas as the main, the awakening factors as the aim of Satipatthana meditations. The awakening factors then have to be practiced with these four qualities, supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and they come in letting go. So after all this, I think important for us to go through it and look at it. And for my part, I'm not ready to let it go, but you are certainly free to put up any question or comment that you still have on the Bakula issue. After that, I will be getting into some more of the discourses on marvels and extraordinary qualities that we get in this chapter. Yeah, so I seem you are all letting go. I hope you're not letting go of me also. We are moving on with our extraordinary qualities and marvels, and now we get some that I think most of you will like because we get marvels of the Dharma. Yeah, they're much more palatable, at least to us. So the background situation is there is an asura. This is a kind of mythological being that are populating early Buddhist thought world. And this asura lives in the ocean, and he describes 8 qualities that the asuras really like about the ocean. Asura sometimes translated as titans, but I think it's best to keep the Pali or Sanskrit asura. And when he has said there are these 8 wonderful qualities of the ocean, which is why we asuras love the ocean so much, The Buddha then comes up with 8 qualities of the Dharma, and he compares them to the qualities of the ocean. So I will read these qualities just as from the bottom to the surface, the ocean becomes gradually greater in circumference, evenly and uniformly increasing up to the shore. And just as its water is always full but never overflowing, similarly, my true teaching and discipline is to be gradually practiced, gradually trained in, gradually completed, and gradually taught. Just as the ocean's tide is never out of time, similarly, in my true teaching and discipline, the monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen will never, until the end of their lives, break the precepts which I have established for these clansmen. Just as the water of the ocean is very deep, bottomless, and extremely broad, boundless, similarly, in my true teaching and discipline, the teachings are profound. Just as the water of the ocean is salty, having everywhere the same taste, similarly, my true teaching and discipline has the taste of dispassion, the taste of awakening, the taste of tranquility, as well as the taste of the path. Just as the ocean abounds with treasures, similarly, my true teaching and discipline abounds with treasures, such as the 4 establishments of mindfulness, the 4 right efforts, the 4 bases of supernormal power, the 5 faculties, the 5 powers, the 7 factors of awakening, and the 8-fold noble path. Just as in the ocean dwell most wonderful and most remarkable beings, similarly, in my true teaching and discipline, there is the community of noble ones, of great spiritual beings, all dwelling within it, namely arahants, those who are on the path to arahantship, non-returners, and those who are on the path to non-returning, once-returners, and those who are on the path to once-returning, and stream-enterers, and those who are on the path to stream-entering. Just as the ocean is pure and does not accept corpses, and if someone dies in the ocean, the body is blown by the wind and thrown up on the shore overnight. Similarly, in my true teaching and discipline, the noble assembly is pure. It does not accept corpses. If there are those who are without vigor, wicked, fake celibates, though professing to be celibates, fake recluses, though professing to be recluses, that even though they may be in the midst of the community of nobles, they are far away from the community of nobles, and the community of nobles is far away from them. And the last, just as there are 5 large rivers of Jambudipa, Jambudipa is India, that enter the ocean, having entered it, forsake their original names and are all just called Great Ocean. Similarly, in my true teaching and discipline, the warrior, Brahmin, merchant, householders, worker clansmen, who shave off hair and beard, don the yellow robe, leave home out of faith and go forth to practice the path, these forsake their original names and are all called recluses. Yeah, we get a similar description in the Anguttara Nikaya, under the 8. So the first quality was the gradual training. The second was not transgressing the rules. The illustration in the Pali version is a little different. It speaks of the ocean not transgressing its shore. And the Madhyama Agama version was, let me just go back, that the tide is never out of time. Yeah, the problem of transgressing the shore, especially in Sri Lanka since tsunami, we know that this is not always the case. So I personally, I can relate better to the idea of the ocean's tide. But it might also be sometimes off. I don't know so much about the ocean. The third quality is that there's no communion with the wicked, and this is the 7th quality in the Madhyama Agama. And the 4th is that the 4 castes become one. That is the last one we just read through, this image of like the rivers flowing into the ocean. So from any caste, one just becomes a Buddhist monk. The fifth quality is that nirvana is not affected by how many realize it, just as the ocean is not affected by the rivers that flow into it. And this quality is not found in the Madhyama Agama version. There's a different quality in the Madhyama Agama version which speaks about the profundity of the teaching. And I find this, this is actually one of the two that really touches me. Yes, quality number three. Just as the ocean is very deep, so the teachings are very profound. The idea of the, I had that before when reading the Pali, the idea that the nirvana element could become full because so many realize it, it seems a little, it's something that I've never been really fully understanding so well. Anyhow, I mean, these are just side by side. Then the salty, this is the one that I particularly take to, like the ocean is salty wherever one tastes it. So the teaching has the same taste. And in the Pali, it just speaks about the taste of liberation, the vimutti rasa. And that is really, really catches me. The Madhyama Agama has four: dispassion, awakening, tranquility, and the taste of the path. We have an Ekottarika Agama parallel that only has the path, and it says it's the Eightfold Noble Path. So all of these are fine, but if my personal preference of this the taste of liberation is really something that really catches me. Yeah. And then the others are, again, there's treasures in the ocean or treasures in the Dharma, and there are remarkable beings in the ocean, and there are remarkable beings and noble beings in the Dharma. Yeah. For the discussion on the blog during the next week, it would be very interesting to see which of these qualities participants speak to them and for what reason would be a nice way. There's a comment here by Rosa. Five sounds rather Brahminic, Upanishadic. That's an interesting idea, Rosa. Yeah, I had just not been able to relate to that before, because nirvana as an element that could be affected by those who realize it, the idea never occurred to me in the first place, so there was no need to point this out as a marva kind of. And when I found that this is absent from the Madhyama Agama, and the Madhyama Agama has one that to me reads very simple and clear, the ocean is profound and the Dharma is profound, I felt my own difficulty to understanding this a little bit justified, kind of. Yeah, in fact, as Rosa said, it's the only way that's not in the Chinese. So we can simply put a question mark on it. It's something that's not really immediately evident to me. But maybe some of the other participants in the course will be able to help us to see some meaning in it. There must be eight qualities after all. It's in the eights of the Anguttara Nikaya. So the main point is that these similes illustrate qualities of the Dharma. And I think most of us would agree that these are really marvelous and we have no problems with them, I suppose. If you have problems, please feel free to speak up. But they are not as problematic as earthquakes and lights when the Buddha gets born, and not as problematic as our friend Bakula, whom now, following Rosa's advice, I'm letting go of. Lisa, how often did the Buddha explicitly refer to caste? Is very explicit. And where can one read more about the reaction to this during the Buddha's time? The topic of caste comes up relatively regularly in the suttas. and there's the Buddha himself and sometimes also his disciples refuting certain claims, particularly the idea that the Brahmins are the foremost caste and that they are therefore superior and are able to practice a form of mental purification or other purification that is not available to other castes. The reaction to this during the Buddha's time is a little more difficult because alongside the Buddhist discourses, we do not have so much other material to let us know how other people reacted to this. It's a little complex. There is quite a lot of literature on this topic. So if you wish, I can look and put a few things together. There's a whole monograph on caste. There's also some more simple, like I think Malala Sekara or Jai Vikram or Jai Tilaka, they have written on caste that should be available from the Buddhist Publication Society. I can look up and send you some references if you're interested in that topic. But it seems to me fairly probable that what the Buddhist texts there represent is the situation more or less in contemporary India at their time. But I'm often not aware of so much corroborating evidence. This is still a very early period, and the Jain scriptures are being put into writing only much later. But the topic of caste seems to have been, as far as we are able to judge from the discourse, a very prevalent one. Could moving from the Dharma to another marvel, earthquakes. We get three reasons for an earthquake. This earth rests upon water, the water rests upon wind, and the wind depends upon space. Ananda, there comes a time when a great wind begins blowing in the sky. When the wind begins blowing, the water becomes disturbed, and the water disturbed, the earth quakes. So this is the first explanation for an earthquake. It has just been an earthquake, so Ananda came to the Buddha and said, how come this happened? And the Buddha gives him these three reasons. First one is obviously based on ancient Indian conceptions of cosmology. The second one then, a monk who possesses great supernormal power, great and mighty virtue, great merit, great and mighty power, is able, with the supernormal power of mastery over the mind, to develop perception of the earth as minute and perception of water as infinite. On account of this, this earth behaves according to his wish, according to his will, being disturbed again and again, quaking again and again. So here we get the idea that somebody who has supernormal powers is actually able to influence outer events in nature by having a perception of earth as small and perception of water as infinite. And we have above the explanation that the earth rests on water, and so by having shrunken earth in his perception, he is then able to shake it. I just think it's interesting for us to know that these passages, I think they are meant literally. I don't think how we could interpret them as symbolically. So it's clear that early Buddhism believes in these supernatural powers and feats of the type that can affect out there, the outer world, in a way that goes diametrically opposite to our understanding of modern sciences. And then the same ability, a monk who has such supernormal powers, when he gets reborn as a deva, he will be able to do the same thing. And the other reason why an earthquake may happen is that a Tathagata is about to pass away. If a Tathagata will be attaining final nirvana soon, within 3 months, for this reason the earth quakes violently. So there we have these three basic ideas. There's first of all the idea how ancient Indians thought an earthquake comes about. They have this idea that earth and below there is all water. The second, that it is possible to supernatural powers, meditative powers, that one does that intentionally. And the third, this idea that outer world responds to events of a spiritual significance. We had that already with the marvels of the Buddha, that he's born and then there's an earthquake and lights. And here again, the earth, this is such a monumental event that the Buddha is attaining final nirvana soon, in 3 months, and somehow this makes the earth quake. And in the Anguttara Nikaya parallel, then the 3 come up to 8. And this narration has then become part of the story of what happened before the Buddha's final nirvana. We find it also in the Mahaparinirvana Sutta. And the other 5 causes why an earthquake takes place is when the Bodhisattva leaves the heaven to enter the womb of his mother, when he comes out of the womb of his mother, when he becomes awakened, when he sets in motion the wheel, and when he actually attains final nirvana. This earthquake was 3 months before. So here we find an expansion of this motif of outer nature responding to events of specific spiritual significance. This is a question by Hugo. My understanding is that renunciants are above the caste despite where they came from, and that was established prior to the Buddha. I think actually that they were outside of the 4 castes, but particularly the Brahmins were quite definite that renunciants were below them. They were looking down on them and denigrating them. And there's one discourse in the Digha Nikaya that starts with some Brahmin monks, in fact, complaining to the Buddha after he asked them that, look, after we became monks, these Brahmins call us with all these bad names, because by becoming renunciants, they have given up their Brahminical status and are therefore considered as far inferior. They are menials, shavelings. They shave their hair like that was actually a punishment for crimes. And the proper Brahmin has this beautiful long hair, the males also, that he washes. And so the renunciant is outside of the caste system, but not above it. At least as far as the Brahmins are concerned, he is certainly considered lower. And this was, you are right, this was already established at the time of the Buddha, the Shramana tradition. And yeah, I can just, let me give you that reference. I just forgot which discourse that is. I think it must be the Aganya Sutta. Yeah, you can read the Aganya Sutta, that is Digha Nikaya number 27, and it starts with precisely this point where the Brahmins are saying, look, you have gone forth from Brahmin families and now they are reviling me. They say the Brahmin caste is the highest caste and only Brahmins can be purified, and you are shaveling petty ascetics, dark fellows born of Brahma's foot, whereas the Brahmins are born from his mouth. So there's this whole denigration of Buddhist monks, because by becoming Shramanas, by becoming renunciants, they have lost their Brahmin caste status. Digha Nikaya 27, Aganya Sutta. Yeah, so here we have another marvel, the causes of earthquakes. I suppose this is maybe one of those marvels that at least some of us are not so enthusiastic as the marvels of the Dharma. Yeah, then we get another one on the marvels of the Dharma, and it's the same basic pattern that we had with the discourse earlier, only there's a story that goes before that. There's a story that the Buddha was reciting the Padimokkha, the monastic code of rules. This every fortnight, monks and nuns separately, they meet as a group, and you see in their times, because they had nothing to write down, then somebody recites the rules. This is a way of making everybody remember, let me see, did I do something wrong or not? And then one has to confess. It seems originally the idea was that one confesses at the actual recitation, but soon enough, and this is the practice nowadays, we confess before. We monks meet and we confess to each other any faults we have made. Nowadays we have also our little booklets with the Patimokkha, so we can look it up. We don't need to rely on our memory or the next recitation. We confess before. And then there's this idea that the Patimokkha is then recited in a pure assembly. And the Buddha is supposed to be reciting the Code of Rules. Presumably that is what he did in the initial stages of the development of the monastic order. And the discourse really builds up tension. As Ananda or somebody else saying, one day it's time to recite, and the Buddha doesn't reply. And some time passes, and he asks again and asks again. And finally, the night is almost over. The monks have been sitting there in front of the Buddha the whole time, and the Buddha says he can't recite because there is an impure monk in the assembly. And then, even when he has said that, this monk keeps sitting. I assume he must have done something rather grave. And then Mahamoggallana, with his psychic power, he spots the monks, gets him and throws him out. Bolts the door and tells the Buddha, now the assembly is pure, you can recite. And the Buddha says, okay, but from now on I'm not going to recite the rules, you have to do it yourself. So after this introductory story, then we again get this 8 qualities of the Dharma. And they are the same that we've already been looking at, so I'll just quickly touch on them again in the hope that you might be inspired to say something about them on the blog. The gradual training, the non-transgressing of the rules, the profundity of the Dharma, the taste of liberation or awakening like a salty taste of seawater, the treasures in the ocean like meditation treasures, and amazing creatures down in the depth of the ocean like these amazing noble beings. And the wicked one, if they're not being thrown out by Moggallana, they're washed to the shore. And the forecast is irrelevant in early Buddhism. It has become relevant in later forms of Buddhism. And they disappear and all become just as rivers join in the ocean. So we are back to the qualities of the Dharma. Now we get marvelous lady disciples. Don't tell me there are no lady disciples getting teachings and getting praise. There's the householder Ugga. And there are some his marvelous qualities. Again, there are 8. Some wonder if all these 8s have formed in a chapter on 8s and later become part of the Madhyama Agama, when there was this idea of forming a topic of marvel chapter. And the first marvelous quality of Ugga, you will be a little surprised. At the mere sight of the Buddha, he sobered up. Yeah, he was drunken. And he gained strength during a gradual talk at that first meeting. Nota bene. And now the others are more standard. Since then, he kept the 5 precepts and lived in celibacy. And his chief wife, he remarries her to someone else she likes to be married to, and he feels no regret. He tells her, look, I want to be practicing meditation, so if you want to marry somebody else. And she says, yes, yes, I want that one. And he's like, okay, you can have him. And he does not look down on any monk, even if the monks are not particularly well-behaved or attained. And he makes offerings to monks without any discrimination, even though he is actually aware whether they are higher developed in their practice or not. And there are gods who come to inform him of the qualities of the Buddha and his disciples. And he has eradicated the 5 lower fetters. So by the time of these marvels, he has proceeded from stream entry to non-return. Yeah, so he was actually, he had drunken alcohol. He was out somewhere having fun. Picnic, we would call it today. And then he happened to meet the Buddha. He sobered up, and during that very first meeting, he became a stream enterer. The Pali version agrees. I'm just giving you the reference here. Chittam Pasiri Sura Maro Chapahi. So at the moment of seeing, his mind became full of joy and the Sura Mada, the alcohol, disappeared. The inebriation disappeared. And it's interesting though that we have two discourses with these qualities of Uga, and this is Anguttara Nikaya 8.22. In 8.21, the preceding discourse, we get the eight qualities a little differently, and this one has the same statement without the last part. So there we only have, on seeing the Bhagavata, the Blessed One, his mind became inspired, but the part on the alcohol has disappeared. That's a little difficult thing, obviously, for tradition to struggle with it, because it's obvious that alcohol is not appropriate and it's a breach of the precepts. And so these kind of borderline cases are a little challenging, I think. There's another one, I just give you the reference for anybody who likes to look it up. Story of Sarakani in the Samyutta Nikaya. This is 5524, volume 5, 375. In Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, this is page 1811. Yeah, he is declared by the Buddha to have passed away as a stream enterer. And he's a Shakyan, and the other Shakyans complain because they say, hey, he was drinking. How could that fellow be a stream enterer? And the Buddha then explains that Sarakani completed the training at death time. So, there's some different interpretations of this story. My personal take is that there's something that in the early suttas we call it the Dhammanusari or Saddhanusari. Some who has either by dint of understanding the Dharma or by dint of his strong confidence in the Dharma has moved up to a level where stream entry is bound to happen before he or she passes away. So it could be assumed that at some point he went up to that level, but because that's not really an attainment level where defilements are being eradicated, he fell back, and maybe he had bad company, we don't know, and he got back into this taking a drink from time to time. I don't think he would have been boozing every day, but just not keeping away from the stuff. And that when old age and death came close, he stopped that. And definitely at the time of death, he was fully established in morality. And because of the practice he had done earlier, he then got the breakthrough to stream entry. That's just my way of putting this story together. But yeah, we can take along from that the alcohol should definitely be avoided, but in the early discourse we get these two borderline cases, Uga and Sarakani, where in spite of some drinking, they have been able to make the breakthrough. Yeah. Then there is Majjhima Agama 39, which does not have a Pali parallel. This is again offering Uga. The story is that he is giving so much of offerings and support to the community of monks that the monks get worried that he becomes poor. And they ask Ananda to tell him to stop this. And so Ananda is very circumspect about it. He asks them to give him an explicit command. He feels a little uncomfortable about it. But then he tells Uga, look, we actually think, be careful, don't just throw out all your offerings. Like this, you will just become poor. And then Uga explains that he has his aspirations and therefore he wants to continue like that. And then he gives another exposition of his marvelous qualities, which are the same as those we had in the discourse before. These eight qualities. So these are his marvels. Okay, before I go on to Hataka, let me see. Akinchana, last year we had a sutta in which it was said that the stream enter is not established in the five precepts. Only in avoiding the five deeds that led to sure rebirth in hell. Yeah, I do not often recall a sutta that precisely says it in this way. But there is definitely some more ambiguity in this respect in the early discourses compared to later tradition, let us put it like this. And while it is obviously clear that morality has to be kept, this the way of insisting that a precept has to be done exactly precisely in this way and no other way is more a tendency in later tradition. Yeah, Akinshana says that maybe the text was supplied because of the discussion. Yeah, I haven't listened to the lectures last year, so I'm excused. I don't remember. But thank you for pointing that out. Definitely in the case of Uga and Sarakani show some ambivalence around the area of alcohol. There's also a slight ambivalence around the area of killing living beings if that refers to insects. It's not entirely clear, but it could be that at the very early stage insects were not considered living beings, and that the we find often, like sometimes in the Pali, that's just killing living beings, and then the Chinese version adds including insects and ants. And if I don't recall wrongly, the reference to insects and ants is only found in Pali Vinaya, not in the discourses. And the Vinaya has been open for a little longer time. This is not a definite thing, but there seems to be some ambivalence in that area around these two precepts. So here, Madhyama Agama 40, the discourse to Hataka, and Hataka is another lay person with marvelous qualities, and he comes with a large following. And the Buddha asks him, how come you have so many friends? And so Hataka says, there are four qualities how I have such great assembly. Charitable giving, speaking friendly, providing helpful advice, and being impartial. And this is another very beautiful thing, and I think that's very practical. That's, I think, we all can relate to. Somebody who is willing to share his wealth to help us, somebody who has a friendly way of speaking to us, somebody who gives advice that is really helpful, and somebody who at the same time remains impartial. That is really qualities that make for friendship. So if I have say in influencing the blog, I would also suggest, if you feel like commenting on this, which you find particularly meaningful, these qualities that make for friendship. Very beautiful. There's some comments here. Juliana, keeping the precept on alcohol, I hear friends who feel that if a glass of wine doesn't lead to heedlessness, then there is no breach. For meditators, one is more sensitive, and I think even a very small quantity makes the difference. But at times I don't know what to say in response to this. Yeah, I mean, I can only say for myself, I wouldn't want to take a glass of wine, even if that were allowed for me as a monk, precisely because I feel already at that much, it does make a change to the mind. And Akinshana, but the Arahant who killed ants in walking was blind, he did not see them. That's a different story, Venerable Akinshana. That is a story in the commentaries about an Arahant who was blind and killed ants. I was just talking about killing, the definition of killing living beings as one of the precepts, which actually is a precept for lay people mostly. The question of unintentional killing is obviously, yeah. Yeah, there's last one. I just quickly go through this one. This is, again, our Hataka. And here we get some of his marvelous qualities. He has few desires, faith, a sense of shame, scruple, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. And in the Anguttara Nikaya, he has only seven qualities, which, as it comes among the eight, so we think that maybe one quality may have been lost. And these are faith, virtue, a sense of shame, scruple, great learning, charitableness, and wisdom. Relatively similar. But there are some questions here. Akinshana, alcohol. I remember when I was a student in Germany, I used to get slightly drunk, not from taking alcohol, but just from sitting in a group where others were drinking. Yeah, the energy catches over, no? And Lisa, Juliana, if we think of mindful and unmindful consumption, the cultivation of plants for alcohol is actually harmful to the earth. Yeah, that's also a point. Yeah, and please don't get me wrong. I'm not telling you to drink, and I'm not telling you to go around and kill insects now. I just point out that it one has the impression that at the earliest stage, the concern with these two was definitely there. You shouldn't kill living beings. You shouldn't drink alcohol. But it was not as precisely formulated as we get it in later tradition. Not really grapes in the country in Italy. Okay. Yeah, they are discussing about whether alcohol is harmful to the earth. Yeah. Yeah. So, actually, this is precisely also our time to finish. Yeah, it has been wonderful to be doing this 11 sessions with you, and I do not recall a single session where I did not learn something from your questions or from your comments on the blog. I really appreciate it, and if it should be possible to do the same thing next year, I very much welcome you. In case not, it will probably be at least the year after. You can look it up on that webpage. If something is happening, I will be posting a note by the end of the year, and then I would be mailing out information to all of you from this Madhyama Agama email around February, before the course starts, so you have time to enroll if you are interested. So thank you once again, and I wish all of you well.